I'd like to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals for our 3 o'clock oral argument. We have one case set for 3 o'clock, and I understand everybody's here and has checked in. I'll introduce the panel to you before we get started. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. And if everybody's ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Sister Initiative LLC, David Bagwell and Susan Bagwell versus Broughton Maintenance Association, Incorporated, et al. May it please the court, Mr. Jason P. Stee will argue for the appellant. Mr. H. Destin Fillmore III will argue for the appellee.
Mr. Stee.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'll just take a minute at the beginning and note that the statute that's at the heart of this case, Section 22230 of the Texas Business Organizations Code, has exactly zero cases that have cited or addressed or discussed that statute in any way. Section 22230 is the nonprofit organization statute version of the statute. Section 22418 is the for-profit version of the statute. There are about 4 cases that address some aspect of Section 22418, but not in a way that's relevant to issues that are raised in this case. So this case presents an important opportunity for the court to provide a lot of guidance about how these statutes work in the real world for business organizations that that engage in what are sometimes interested transactions, which happens with some frequency. Where these statutes come from is the safe harbor provisions that we're dealing with, which is subsection B of Section 22230, and that's the where you have an interest in transaction under subsection A. Then subsection B talks about if those interested transactions are approved by the majority of disinterested directors, or if the transactions are fair to the corporation. Those are the two safe harbors. In those situations, the interested transaction is still valid and enforceable. It is not void or voidable under those safe harbors. Now, those safe harbors existed at the common law.
This absolves even a contract that's found to be an absolute breach of fiduciary duty. 22230 absolves all sins if there's either a vote or the contract. I assume it wouldn't be fair under those circumstances. But if there's a vote of a disinterested director, 22230 absolves all sins.
Well, absolves all sins is not quite the way to frame it, because any sin under a breach of fiduciary duty requires an action for breach of fiduciary duty. What this does is preempts any action for breach of fiduciary duty.
The statute also uses the words otherwise valid contract or transaction. So how are we supposed to interpret those words?
Well, I think that means if you had an agreement that was invalid on some other ground, not having anything to do with the fact that it's an interested transaction. I guess the only thing that's maybe potentially alleged as some other ground for invalidity here is the metadata argument that the HOAs are making about the written document being somehow invalidly executed. Our argument is that's a red herring. It's completely irrelevant here, because these loans under the statute of frauds don't have to be papered in writing in the first place. So the notion that they're invalid as written documents doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. So there's no other allegation that these loans are in any other way invalid. So the only way they could be invalid is if they are as interested transactions. If there's a problem, it's a self-dealing problem. And under the safe harbors, under subsection B, we argue that both safe harbors are satisfied. The loans in this case were approved by Mr. Crane, who is a disinterested director. They've offered no evidence to support the idea that Mr. Crane was an interested director.
But approved only through the consents or the ratification. There is no corporate resolution that specifically refers to the sister initiative loans, is there?
There's not a document that says that. There is testimony from both David Bagwell and Susan Bagwell that Mr. Crane approved all the loans. There's also the ratification, which is the equivalent of approval. It's just retroactive instead of prospective, but legally it's the equivalent of approval of all the loans.
I thought that Mrs. Bagwell testified that the only pre-ratification approval was in the form of the consents that were executed in June.
She testified that that there was that consent. She also testified that the loans were approved by the Board of Directors, including Mr. Crane.
Okay.
And Mr. Bagwell also testified that the loans were all approved by the Board of Directors, which includes Mr. Crane. And then we have the ratification, which itself is, there's no valid argument or evidentiary basis for construing the ratification as somehow not good, somehow invalid. They make some arguments about it. There's no valid argument.
Well, there's no question that, theoretically, there's no question that the ratification was indeed done at the time that it was purported to be done, or that the terms were what it purports to be. There is a question about whether or not the scope of the ratification covers the approval necessary under 22230.
Well, I don't think there is. The ratification states in no uncertain terms that all of the HOAs, and there's a separate ratification for each HOA, and all three directors' signatures appear on each one of those ratifications, and each ratification states in no uncertain terms that all of the HOAs prior contracts and contracts and transactions are ratified by the Board of Directors. All means all. There's all kinds of case law that says all means all.
But 22230 also specifies that the approval process is directed towards the contract or transaction.
Yes, but the contracts and transactions have all been ratified by the ratification in no uncertain terms. There's no language in Section 22230 that requires any kind of special vote, any kind of individual vote for each individual contract. They try to make that argument, but that's reading words into the statute that don't exist. There are no words in the statute that say that. The statute just says that the contract, and again, the rules of statutory construction are pretty clear about this, and there's a lot of case law about it. The plural includes the singular includes the plural. All the statute says is that the contract at issue, which would in this case be any one of the given loans at issue, that contract has to be approved by the majority of disinterested directors. The ratification approves all prior contracts by the HOAs. That is all that is needed under Section 22230. There's no language in the statute that requires anything more than that. Again, they make arguments to that effect, but there's no validity to those arguments. Now, once that safe harbor is satisfied, once these loan agreements have been either voted prospectively to be approved by the board or retroactively by the ratification, once that happens, the loan agreements are valid and enforceable under the statute, and under subsection E, 22230E, it says the HOAs do not have a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty against any of the interested directors on the board. So they just don't have the cause of action in the first place. So it's not absolving sins of breach of fiduciary duty, it's just simply preventing any action to begin with before you could ever find out whether there were sins or not under a breach of fiduciary duty. These loans are valid under Section 22230. They're enforceable under 22230. And that means their counterclaim for breach of fiduciary duty evaporates. They have none. That means that the court has to reverse the trial court's judgment. And they've conceded. They've made no argument that there needs to be a retrial on our breach of contract claim. There's no dispute here. We entered loan agreements. Sister Initiative and the HOAs entered loan agreements. They don't dispute that. There's no dispute about the terms of the loan agreements. No dispute whatsoever about that. There's no dispute that the loans were funded. There's no dispute that they began to repay the loans. There is no dispute at all about the existence of these loan agreements and them receiving the money and beginning to repay the money. The only dispute here is that they've alleged that somehow the loans are invalid or voidable because of the interested transaction. Again, there's no evidence to support that. Mr. Crane is a disinterested director here. They've got no evidence to the contrary. That means their breach of fiduciary duty claim evaporates. It's undisputed. We have loan agreements that they've breached by not repaying fully. That means the court can not just reverse the trial court's judgment, but render judgment in our favor that they are in breach of the loan agreements and that we're entitled to recover the principal plus interest plus costs and attorney's fees. And that's the judgment we're asking the court to make. Now, even if the court does somehow reach the conclusion that Mr. Crane was an interested director, or that these loans should be voided somehow, the court still should reverse the trial court's judgment for two reasons. Even if they have a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, they've provided no evidence, and there is no evidence, to connect a breach of fiduciary duty that they're alleging with regard to the interested loan transactions. They've alleged no, they've presented no evidence, there is no evidence to connect that breach of fiduciary duty with the amounts in damages that were actually awarded. They were repaying the loans, they were repaying borrowed money. That cannot possibly be construed as out-of-pocket damages, out-of-pocket losses, when what they're doing is repaying borrowed money. Undisputedly, that's what they're doing.
Why can't the court's findings and conclusions be construed as a forfeiture of the loans?
So as a forfeiture, it would have to be a benefit to the Bagwells. The repayments they were making on borrowed money, those are repayments to Sister Initiative. Sister Initiative is not the Bagwells. The Bagwells are the directors who are being sued for breach of fiduciary duty. If they have a claim for breach of fiduciary duty against the Bagwells, there needs to be some benefit to David or Susan Bagwell that is construed as a benefit, and therefore that benefit is forfeited back to the HOAs. There's no evidence of any benefit.
The court concluded that there was a conspiracy between Sister Initiative and the Bagwells, and that Sister Initiative was an aider and abettor.
What that does is, assuming that Sister Initiative is liable under conspiracy and is jointly liable for whatever is construed as a benefit that's going to be forfeited back to the HOAs, Sister Initiative is jointly liable for that. That doesn't amount to a finding that the repayments on borrowed money to Sister Initiative were a benefit to the Bagwells. That's what there has to be. There has to be evidence that the Bagwells benefited from this breach of duty in a way that benefit needs to be forfeited to the HOAs. What was awarded were the amounts that were repaid on the loans from Sister Initiative. Those repayments were made to Sister Initiative, and there's no evidence connecting those repayments to David and Susan Bagwell. So there's no benefit, that they haven't proven any benefit to David and Susan Bagwell connected to the amounts that they were awarded in as a forfeiture. So there's nothing to support that award. It has to be reversed. They've got to show either harm to themselves, out-of-pocket damages, or they've got to show a benefit to David or Susan Bagwell to support the damages awarded, and they've done nothing to show either of those things. What they can maybe show, assuming that we don't win under 22230, and they do have a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty, what they at most can show is that they were harmed in out-of-pocket damages to the tune of whatever little interest they were paying on the loans that they began to repay. That would be their out-of-pocket damages, whatever handful of dollars that interest amount would be. That's the most they can show in terms of actual damages if they have a cause of breach of fiduciary duty in the first place. And then what we have, and this is again assuming we don't win under 22230 and they do have a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty, we still have a claim for money hadn't received, because there is absolutely no legal authority whatsoever, no legal or factual basis for the borrowers to keep borrowed money after the loan agreements are voided. Right now, the way the trial court's judgment stands, they not only get back the money they began to repay on the loans, but they also keep all the principal loan amounts that they were originally given. They keep over $120,000 in free money. There is no authority for that. Even under strict usury laws, when a loan is declared to violate usury laws, there are statutory penalties, but the borrower does not get to keep the borrowed money, even under usury laws. There's no authority, no basis whatsoever for the HOAs to keep Sister Initiative's loaned money free and clear and walk away with a $320,000-something. So again, we think the court should reverse the trial court's judgment and render judgment in our favor on our breach of contract claim, because it's not disputed that we have loan agreements that they have refused to pay. But even if we don't win under 22230 and they have a breach of fiduciary duty claim against us, the most they can get in out-of-pocket damages is the interest they began to repay, and we need to get our principal back under our money hadn't received claim, because there's no basis for the borrower to keep all the borrowed money. We also have cited authority in our briefing that on an equitable money hadn't received claim, there in some cases, on equitable grounds, it may be possible to recover attorney's fees. We think that would be that's an equitable question that would be most properly addressed by the trial court. And that, again, this is assuming we're falling back on money hadn't received and not winning on 22230. But there is authority that attorney's fees can be recovered even on the equitable claim for money hadn't received when the equities weigh in favor of that. And we would argue that in this case, where the HOAs have fought tooth and nail with this scorched earth strategy to prevent us from recovering principal loan amount, that in this case, the equities would weigh in favor of also recovering attorney's fees, again, if we have to fall back on the equitable claim that we're asserting. Our position, though, is that we win under Section 22230. There's no evidence to show that Mr. Crane is an interested director in these transactions. And if the court doesn't have any additional questions, I'll cede my time.
Thank you, counsel. Response?
May it please the court, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by pointing the court out to the fact that the appellants are seeking a render, which I think limits the court to a legal insufficiency standard of review in this case, as this court has recently held in Dunn versus Mangtai Petroleum Corporation. That's a July 11, 2019 opinion, 2019 WL3024479 at note 1. And so the problem with the appellant's case is there has been a failure to meet the burden of proof under the Texas Business Organizations Code, under any section of it. And addressing your question, Justice Basil, with regard to 22230B1A, I think one of the provisions of that is that the Board of Directors still has to be acting in good faith and with ordinary care. It's not just simply a vote of disinterested directors. The board itself has to be acting in good faith and with ordinary care in order to pass muster under that particular section. They were not in this case. The trial court explicitly found that they were not. At least two-thirds of the board members were acting in breach of their fiduciary duty and acting in their self-interest to basically perpetrate a scam on these HOAs to basically double their money, and that's what we've heard here today. The other thing that that is of interest is, with regard to your question, otherwise is the contract otherwise enforceable? The judge in this case found that there was no consideration to support these contracts. Why is that? Because the HOAs didn't receive any benefit. There was nothing no consideration for the HOAs at all. The money simply flowed through the bank accounts of the HOAs into the coffers of Evermore, and the trial court was very careful to point out that the HOAs didn't owe Evermore any money. So causing money to flow through the HOA bank accounts into the Evermore accounts was improper. In fact, the trial court found that the contract between the HOAs and Evermore likewise did not pass muster under the Business Organizations Code. Those contracts between Evermore and the HOAs were interested party contracts as well, signed by David Bagwell for both the HOAs and Evermore. And the trial court made extensive findings that the contracts between the HOAs and Evermore don't pass muster under the Business Organizations Code. And so there was no opportunity or no reason for the HOAs to be legitimate reason for the HOAs to be sending Evermore any money at all. Now, with regard to these contracts, appellants say that we don't dispute the terms of the contracts. Absolutely dispute the terms of the contracts. The appellants went to trial not on oral contracts, on these written contracts that the trial court found to be fabricated based upon the metadata. And the metadata shows, and this is in 19 supplemental reporters record in the 600s, that, for example, the September 2, 2010 Old Grove note, the creation date was in February of 2011, and it was still being modified as late as September 5 of 2011 after every one of the board members were no longer on the Old Grove board. They're still modifying the Word document that they ultimately attached to a copy of which they ultimately attached to their pleading. The trial court found that these documents are fabricated, and the trial court specifically said that even though I admitted them into evidence, I am according these documents zero weight, no evidentiary weight. Well, what What the appellants are trying to do by switching the argument to, oh, well, we have oral contracts. Well, what were the terms of those oral contracts? Oh, well, these just happen to be the terms that are set forth in the fabricated written contracts that we went to trial on, and we got caught fabricating evidence, and the court accorded that zero evidentiary weight. Well, what they're doing is they're smuggling evidentiary weight by pointing to contracts that have no evidentiary weight and saying, well, look to those contracts for the terms. That's giving those contracts evidentiary weight. The trial court said, I'm not giving those contracts any evidentiary weight.
What does the record say about whether or not there was any corporate action to approve these loans other than the consents and the ratifications? Was there some other act of these HOAs?
There were no other acts, and the consents, the June 2010 consents, the court specifically found are fabricated documents as well. That was proved not only by the metadata. Mr. Bagwell admitted that he didn't know when he signed those consents, the June 2010 consents. That's at 4 Supplemental Reporters Record 44, approximately line 21. Dale Crane admitted that the consents didn't exist as of August 30, 2010. That's 12 Supplemental Reporters Record 121. We have a July 12, and the reason that Dale Crane admitted that they didn't exist is because the consents reference the fact that the HOA were provided loan documents, like sample loan documents by counsel. That didn't occur until the fall of 2010, months after the June 2010 consents. And that's what Dale Crane had to admit, and they had to admit that the consents were backdated. But the other thing is, in July of 2011, Defendant's Exhibit 226, there is an email from Dale Crane to Mrs. Bagwell that attaches a copy of only the Broughton 2010 consent with only his signature, only Dale Crane's signature, not David Bagwell's signature, not Mrs. Bagwell's signature, with an email saying along the lines of, well, what about the other consents? So they hadn't even signed the June 2010 consents, even in July of 2011. And so we also provided the court the August 1, 2011 email, Defendant's Exhibit 230, where we actually see the board scrambling to paper the file. Mrs. Bagwell writes, I'm still going over the emails and the record books to be sure we've documented all the action we've taken. Did you have a chance to look at the note forms I sent you last night? That's how another way we know that the note forms did not exist as of August 1 of 2011, even though they're all dated in 2010, except for where there were a couple in 2011 early. But they were fabricating evidence all during that time, and that's what the metadata shows. The metadata shows that the Broughton consent was created on November 30 of 2010 and last edited on December 1. The Old Grove was created on December 1, 2010. The Whittier Heights was created on December 1, 2010. But the metadata also shows that on August 26 of 2011, they created a file called Executed Consents for each one of these consents. Now, August 26 of 2011, these people are no longer on the Old Grove board. They're no longer on the Broughton board. And they only have 5 more days left on the Whittier board. And so the metadata shows they're scrambling to to create documents, basically, to cover their tracks. The ratification, and incidentally, we believe that what the legislature in 230B1A, when it calls for a vote, it's talking about a vote, not a ratification. A vote is a forward-looking thing. A vote is where people get together and decide what they are about to do and vote on it and then go do it. A ratification is a backward-looking, a rearward-looking thing. And what they've done in this case is they've conflated those two things. And the reason they have is the August 1 ratification. And we don't believe that is a legitimate date either, Your Honor. We do not believe that. We believe that document was created when they were creating the note forms, when they were creating the consents, this during the whole papering the file time in late August and September of 2011, we believe the ratification document is illegitimate, and so did the trial court. The trial court rejected the ratification as well. But in any event, even if we take the ratification as a non-fraudulent document, a non-fabricated for litigation document, the ratification is only allowed in 230B2, which throws them into the fairness inquiry, and that's the inquiry they want to stay way out of. Do not want to start talking about whether these transactions were fair to the HOAs at the time that they were entered into. So that's the reason why they're conflating ratification and vote. There is no evidence of a vote. The consent forms that they point to are fabricated, fraudulent documents as found by the trial court. The ratifications were rejected by the trial court as well, given all of the evidence that came alongside the metadata evidence and proved that these people were fabricating documents, including Mrs. Bagwell, who said that she shredded entire sets of loan documents, and then she told version 2.0 of that evidence shredding story. It's an absolute mess for them, and that's why the trial court rejected that evidence as being credible at all. And so what the appellants are asking this court to do is to make a different credibility determination than what the trial court did, which I believe under the standards of review is an extremely difficult thing for a court of appeals to do, is to go back in and second-guess credibility determinations later in time. After a trial court spent 4 weeks approximately four weeks trying this case, and after the trial court listed in its findings of facts and conclusions of law, I paid careful attention to the witnesses. I watched the demeanor. I made my decisions with regard to the evidence and what I believed, what I didn't believe, and the weight to be given to that testimony and those exhibits. What they're ultimately asking this court to do is to wipe away any sort of standard of review, which the standard of review, according to this court, and I think this court is correct, is near total deference given to the trial court's credibility determinations. Wipe that aside and basically look at this case de novo and just tell us what you all think. What do you think? Would you make a different decision? I don't think that that's what this court is supposed to be about. I think the standards of review bar the court from doing that and bar their arguments. With regard to the argument on money had and received, equity is a very dangerous place for these people to be in, especially given the trial court's specific findings that they were, the entire point of this scam was to breach their fiduciary duties. That was the point. That's what they intended. That's what Mr. and Mrs. Bagwell intended all along. The court specifically found that they did not have clean hands in making any of these loans. And yet they come into this court and with this fiction that we are over here, the HOAs are over here with a bank account stuffed full of sister initiative money, when they know that the evidence showed conclusively as soon as the sister initiative money hit the HOA accounts, it was gone to Evermore, and then from Evermore to David Bagwell, to Mrs. Bagwell, to all sorts of different people, to pay their grocery bills, to pay car payments for one of their daughters. We didn't get any benefit from this money. And so I would not want to go to a Rangers baseball game with Mr. Bagwell, because if he handed $5 down the aisle to get a hot dog, he would look at every one of the patrons that took his $5 and handed it and handed it and handed it down to the vendor and say, money hadn't received. You all owe me $5, every one of you. And that is exactly what they're saying here. The money simply flowed through our accounts. We do not have it. We never really did have it. And that's why the court found that these were semblances of loans, putative loans, semblance. They were shams. The whole thing is a sham. And so it does, and I think we said this in our brief, you come into court and you cry equity after engaging in behavior like this, that takes a level of chutzpah that is just staggering. And that's that, but yet that's exactly what they're doing. With regard to the damages, the court's damages that they awarded, that the court awarded to the HOAs, are tied to the fact that they went through the sham of paying themselves back on debts we didn't owe. They took money out of the account and paid themselves on debts we didn't owe. So the premise of their argument that we have no damages, that it is premised on the fact that the loans were actually legitimate and that we profited from them. I say I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Reply?
I'll try to make a couple of really quick points. The flow-through argument that the HOAs are making depends fundamentally on ignoring the independent existence of at least 8 different legal entities. They want to collapse everything and everybody into quote-unquote the Bagwells, and the Bagwells were paying money to themselves. The money began with the Bagwells, it went through the Bagwells, it went back to the Bagwells.
Counsel, I understand that you've raised that nobody's proved alter ego or anything like that or piercing the corporate veil, but I mean, are you asking us at some fundamental level to second-guess the trial court's credibility determinations?
We haven't made any challenge to any credibility determination. There is one finding where the court talks about the failure to prove, and I might not quite get the quote exactly right, but the failure to prove by a preponderance of credible evidence that the loan agreements had been ratified or something like that. They're trying to make that a credibility determination about the ratification, that the ratification was not credible. Courts don't make credibility determinations about a document, a signed, filed document. Credibility determinations are about witnesses and witness testimony. You don't look at a signed document and decide, I think that's not credible. There's got to be some evidentiary basis for disregarding documentary evidence. Credibility is not how it's done. We haven't challenged any credibility determination. That is a misdirection on their part. We're saying we have, and by the way, I heard for the first time right now that they're challenging, that they're calling the ratification documents backdated. There's no finding that the ratifications were backdated. They just suggested that they are, they believe that they are. There's no evidence of that and no finding of that. What we have are dated ratifications. That there is no challenge to the date of those ratifications. They just floated the idea for the first time, but there is no evidence or finding that the ratifications themselves are backdated. We have dated ratifications. We don't need more than that. Going to your question, Justice Bassel, about whether there was some evidence of a vote in the record, a lot of time spent right now on consents and whether the consents were right. All of that is misdirection. We don't need it. We have dated ratifications that ratify all the loan agreements so that to the extent there was any problem with papering loans that didn't need to be papered in the first place, to the extent there was any problem with that, and by the way, there was no response to the statute of frauds that says these loans don't need to be papered in the first place. To the extent there was any problem with papering those loans that didn't need to be papered, the ratification was a backstop to make sure, look, we agreed to enter these loans. We had disinterested directors on both sides. The Stonegate loans had the Bagwells who were disinterested. The Sister Initiative loans had Mr. Crane who was disinterested. All of these loans are now ratified. The trial court concluded Stonegate's loans are enforceable. There is no way to reconcile that conclusion with the opposite conclusion that Sister Initiative's loans were not valid enforceable. We're not afraid of the fairness argument. The Stonegate loans were found to be fair. Our loans are virtually identical in terms to the Stonegate loans. There's no basis for finding the Stonegate loans fair and the Sister Initiative loans unfair. There's no basis for that. It is irreconcilable. We're not afraid of the fairness argument because the court's already found that identical loans were fair. It doesn't make any sense to find these loans were unfair. What they want to do is tell a story about the Bagwells on all sides. It's the Bagwells giving money to themselves and then paying themselves back. Sister Initiative is not the Bagwells. Evermore is not the Bagwells. Evermore has employees. It was providing maintenance services to the neighborhoods. It had lawnmowers and tree planters, people who are doing things. It has its own revenue and overhead. If money went to Evermore and some bit of that money trickled up to David Bagwell, that has no connection to money, loan money that needs to be repaid to Sister Initiative, a separate entity. They want to ignore the reality of separate corporate entities so that they can collapse it all into the Bagwells and say it's the Bagwells doing all of this and we don't owe any money. When my money, if I borrow money from a bank and it hits my bank account and then I immediately pay bills to another entity, I can't turn around and tell the bank, I don't owe you any money because I don't have the money anymore. That's what they're trying to do. We don't have the money because it went to Evermore, and Evermore is the Bagwells, and the Bagwells have the money. No, Evermore's a separate company. They paid Evermore just like they were supposed to. They owe the loan money back to Sister Initiative. That's how loans work. All of this, a four-week bench trial, is they're saying we're making a mess of things. This is a mess of their creating. This should be a simple case. Sister Initiative loaned money to the HOAs. Sister Initiative wants to get repaid its loan money. That's the case. It's a very simple case. It became a four-week trial because they don't want to pay the money back. They made a mess of this case, and they've tried to, there are all kinds of red herrings and misdirections and a bunch of stuff about a bunch of stuff that doesn't matter. There are loans here that need to be repaid. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, gentlemen, thank you for the oral argument. Your case is submitted.